Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Tara Lynn Lawson.
And I'm Claire Yosef Meyer.
And this is That's What She Said. Today, we'll be talking about Christmas stories and debunking them, like your notions of Christmas and the whole Mary and some other.
We just really love that. If you think about your traditional nativity play, we're gonna sink our teeth into that a little bit today.
And rip it apart.
For fun.
Yes. Will you start? Because I know this comes from part of your childhood.
Yeah. So we're just kind of sharing the amount of Christmas storiness around this time in our faith life that we just have such strong associations with, but aren't necessarily scriptural. So I was sharing my memories of like the nativity play, and Mary always traditionally wears blue, and we're singing Christmas carols about her being meek and mild, and historic church tradition has always identified her as being praiseworthy for her obedience to God. And, you know, she rides the donkey to the stable, and there's a star. So all of these things, it's very, very clear in my mind. All of these things that actually take the nativity story from Luke and the nativity story from Matthew and smash them up into one big glob. And so it's kind of hard to even tease those apart. But particularly what inspired this conversation today is I was sharing with Tara Lynn my great disturbance as an adolescent at the story in Luke 1 that we call the Annunciation, where the angel Gabriel comes to Mary to share this exciting vision that God has for the child to be born and to be the savior of the world. And kind of the culmination of church tradition around this story, again, emphasizing that Mary was this meek, mild individual who was obedient to God, led to a rendition of this story every year in which Mary's consent was not very clear. It just wasn't an acknowledged part of the story at all. We just sort of roll right over how Mary really felt about all of this. If you construe her response to Gabriel as obedience rather than consent, it's a creepy story if you're an adolescent girl. for some adolescent girls.
Yeah, for some. Sure.
And so it was just kind of, it led to this interesting conversation about what is the relevance of Mary's consent or lack thereof in the story, particularly in a modern age where we've been through the Me Too, you know, hashtag Me Too movement in the past few years. Mm-hmm. And there's just kind of more public conversation about these topics, even though it's a somewhat anachronistic conversation because consent is just a very different topic 2,000 years ago than it is today. But theologically speaking, as an adolescent girl, it was a pretty important topic to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do I need to be worried?
When you shared this some months ago, I was taken aback. I thought it was an interesting position, though, because I did not have those reservations growing up. Not even as an adult. I didn't even think about it until you mentioned it. And I said, that's an interesting perspective. And I think that needs to be shared more. How many other women, young girls, young ladies, however you identify, are having this kind of engagement with the text, that it's meant to be a celebratory moment, and some people are just flat out horrified at the prospect of being asked by God to do something that is culturally unacceptable, right? Because that's part of it, mm-hmm. it for Mary anyway. Mm-hmm. How will this be? And then you bring in that consent component. Like, I never even thought about it. And I guess because it's God. But a lot,
no one says no to God.
God does what God wants. And in the era of consent, and it's a different mindset too about a deity. Yeah. And not just a deity, but even when you think about a king, it's not dissimilar to that. when a king asks you to do something, you do it. And because we you mentioned it anachronistic, but mm-hmm. because we have such an individualistic and democratic, I guess, mindset where you need to ask me first.
Before impregnating me.
I know. It's like that. That's a foreign concept. It's mm-hmm. a very foreign notion. And how do you remedy that, right? How do you make a story that is ancient appeal, or how do you make it meet our current sensibilities? And should mm-hmm. it? So there's another other element. Like, do we just take it at face value? Like, this is what it was, and it wasn't about consent. And then just go from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the piece for me that makes it, normally, I don't like anachronistic castbacks, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the whole, like, Jesus was a feminist, right? Like, I tend to sort of be, I want to draw some boundaries here, right? Like, I just don't think that's actually helpful.
Okay.
I think what's hard for me about not resolving that tension mm-hmm. in the story is because it doesn't speak to the time for me. It speaks to God's character, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. right? So if this is a question of God sort of like, well, I'm God, I don't want to hear your back talk about my plan to impregnate you. Like, you know, like, nobody says no to me. This is how I work with people. Yeah. I just tell you what to do. And then I, right? Like, for me, that's not really somebody that I'm like, I love you. I feel so safe uh-huh. with you. I'm so glad you created me so that you could announce to me that it's time to impregnate me with your special, you know, like, yeah. I just, right?
Yeah.
So, and it does that what you said about taking the story that is meant to be beautiful and mm-hmm. celebratory and inspirational and just kind of throws in some really yuck undertones.
Yeah.
When I have preached on this in the past, because I remember before the first time I preached this text in a church, I went to my dad, who is a pastor, mm-hmm. and I was like, I don't think I should, I'm not the right person to preach about this. Mm-hmm. This story, I was, you know, in my mid-20s at this point, I was like, this story has been ick and like sort of in a can on the shelf that I never go to for most of my life.
Okay.
And he was like, well, maybe then you're the person who should be preaching about this, because what I came to realize as I was composing the sermon is I'd never heard anyone with a uterus tell this story. Mm. I've only ever heard men preach about this story. And mm-hmm. When you think about church history, this tale has been in the hands of patriarchal institution and preached on by men for literally thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And so I think when it comes to, I mean, this is not meaning to say like a boo men, right? But but because they themselves don't have uteruses,
typically,
historically, that this isn't something that would necessarily have occurred, right?
True.
But like, I wonder if the women in my congregation are crossing their legs for a reason when I tell this story. Like, what if it's just, like, didn't really occur in the same way maybe that you're expressing, right? Because there could be many, many women who don't have this reaction to the story at all in addition to you, right? Carolyn's the only woman on the planet.
I'm the only one who is okay with this.
Right. And I think I kind of referenced before we started this podcast that it was reminding me of our conversation about women's agency and choice about having carrying pregnancies to term or not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it feels to me like my sensibilities are very connected to, like, I feel that way, whether it's a human impregnation or God. I just do. Mm-hmm. Like, I think if God's like, I'm going to impregnate you, but I don't care whether or not you consent to that situation. That would just be deeply disturbing. And my opinion about women's agency hasn't changed.
No, that is, it's a great point. Again, I will say that it brings into a modern day mindset.
Yeah.
Into a very ancient text and understanding of a woman's role. And going into this, we were talking about how, like, nobody gives consent, not just women, right? Like, Mary doesn't give consent. Mary can say no. That's mm-hmm. the thing. Like, she can say no. That doesn't mean that she won't come to change her mind because of extenuating circumstances, much like the example I gave was Jonah. Jonah doesn't want to go to Nineveh because he knows that God will have compassion on the people. they will change and serve God. And then, and Jonah doesn't want that. Like, Jonah wants judgment. Jonah wants them destroyed. Mm-hmm. Jonah says no, but then Jonah has to do what God says because his path is blocked and impeded at every turn. So we see that male, female, no one does not do what God wants. It sounds weird, but you know what I mean? People do what God wants eventually. And the idea, and I guess why I'm okay with it, because even in my own life, I've said no numerous times. But then when it comes down to it, God has my best interests. Mm-hmm. And so what God is asking me to do isn't harmful. It may be out of the norm. I may think it'll jeopardize some part of myself, but in the long run, it's to my benefit. And we see that. So on one point, yeah, asking Mary, hey, Mary, what do you think about this? Normally, she probably would say no because she's betrothed. She's young. She, you know, the society, she doesn't want any of that. She doesn't want to be stoned, killed, you know. God knows how it's going to end. And so I think partly that's why I'm usually okay with God not asking permission, supposedly. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I know I can say no. Right. Like, there's, and people in the Bible can say no. We just see what happens when they don't do what God asks.
I think that as you're speaking, what is occurring to me about the difference that I think was in the back of my head between Mary and Jonah and others, mm-hmm. is God asking people to do something versus with Mary, it's, I'm going to do this to you.
Okay.
Right. So you can say no when you're Jonah, because God's not going to like puppet you, your body over to Nineveh and like, you know, like take you over, possess you. But like,
oh, yeah,
I think for me, it's very different to say, I'm going to put a life in your body. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's a piece that for me is like, like, I just I don't know. Like, what does that no look like? Because, mm-hmm. yeah. And the second piece that as you're sharing about God's awareness of the forecast, mm-hmm. right? Like, here's this plan. Here's how it's going to go. I can see this future. Part of what for me was really redemptive when I was able to see Mary's consent, which I will in my sermons have argued is in the text. Mm-hmm. Boom, boom, boom. Anachronistic as it is, I think.
Hey, go ahead.
You know? So like the way that I've said this before. So between verse, I think 37, 38, 39, where basically the angel finishes speaking. Mm-hmm. And then Mary says, let it be with me as you have spoke according to your word.
Yeah. Right?
The thing that the Bible doesn't give us is like verse 37.5, brief silence, right? Like, Mary's thinking about it. The angel isn't left yet. Because theoretically, if Mary's voice in this didn't matter, mm-hmm. Gabriel could have spoken and immediately disappeared. True. Right? And been like, that's my message. Bye. Mic drop. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that Mary didn't like, in the instant that Gabriel stopped speaking, was ready with her, like, this sounds great, let's do it.
Yeah.
So I have to assume there was this intervening period, you know, understanding that this is sure. narrative, right? Not mm-hmm. like a historic documentary.
Right, right.
But narratively, that there was some intervening period before she offered her response. And her response is, let it be with me according to your word, which is not the same as like, I am servile, walk all over me. Mm-hmm. But almost for me, it feels like a contractual, like what you have said, I will be a part of.
Yeah.
I choose to be a part of that. Right. Mm-hmm. And then we have her go to Elizabeth and sing the Magnificat, which to me is our closest or our best window into her why, Mary's why she says yes to mm-hmm. this plan, is because it feels like she does understand the scope of God's vision and God's, to some degree, God's mm-hmm. plan for salvation. And she is fully on board for it because she has this passion for the kings being torn from their thrones. Her people are occupied by Rome. She is yeah. devastated by empire. And here comes God to fulfill God's promise, mm-hmm. right, to God's people. And is like, here's how I'm going to do it. It does involve you having this baby. Are you in?
Yeah.
Yeah?
No, those are great points. And the verse to which you were referring is 38. Okay. Luke 1:38. Then Mary said, "Here am I, the servant of the Lord." Here am I. We hear that with which one was it? Isaiah. Here am I.
Yeah, it's kind of like behold.
Yeah, yeah, right. And Isaiah is referenced a lot in this text. So it makes sense that they would even use that same phrasing.
Yeah.
The servant of the Lord, let it be with me according to your word. Then the angel departed from her. Then the angel is like, okay.
Yep.
And this is the NRSV version, popular with Lutherans and Presbyterians. But yeah, so it's consent after the fact. But it's, like I said, Mary can say no. She can say no. That doesn't negate that it won't happen. I hear what you're saying, though. It's very intrusive. Like, it's her body. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, I need you to move yourself. Mm-hmm. I still work from the place of, like, during this time when a woman's sole role primarily was to give birth. So in a sense, she's already receptive to having that invasion, I suppose. Culturally, she's primed.
It's to, a normative expectation.
To be pregnant. And so how glorious then that the Lord would choose this vessel. A role that I'm going to do anyway, like a role that I've already set up to perform, or function I'm already set up to fulfill. And it's just not what I thought. Because, again, the juxtaposition of her story with Elizabeth, like, Elizabeth has given consent.
She wants the child.
Because she wants the child. Like, she's wanted the child. It's a foreshadowing of Mary to give consent. Because Elizabeth has given her consent. So it's like, oh, and then here's this other scenario that's miraculous as well. But because we've had one say yes, we're then set up to think that, of course, the other one will say yes. I'm glad that you raised this question. And not just in the Me Too era, but like we said, I did not think about
it. I'm glad for you. Those are years I can't get back.
But how much fuller is your ministry because you have thought about this? And women who might not have a positive relationship with men, mm-hmm. or those who identify as men because of some catastrophic traumatic event that has happened to them in their lives. And when they hear this story, they're not thinking, oh, how glorious, and let me sing God's praises. They're thinking the intrusion upon this woman's life. Yet another example of how men get to do whatever they want.
Well, and it's such a venerated story that mm-hmm. we praise Mary, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we're like, good for Mary, right? Which, if you're a victim or a survivor, mm-hmm. like, is the last thing you need is veneration of victims for being attacked. You know, like, not that the story in any way in Luke is like, and God attacked Mary, right? But so many cases of having those boundaries crossed and having invasion are gray area situations mm-hmm. anyway. It's not as, like, often as black and white as just being like, I was in an alley and it was a stranger, right? That's the stereotype. But so often it's this really, like, when you tell the story, it's hard to even tell the story because you're just imagining how other people will hear it and be like, well, that doesn't sound like you were attacked, right?
Or
right? Like, you know, maybe you just should have said no louder, or maybe, mm-hmm. right? I mean, or more times, or whatever.
Like, it never occurred to you during that moment to do either of those things.
Right. Well, or how many survivors have the experience of just freezing,
mm-hmm.
right? And then feeling guilty or feeling complicit somehow because I should have done more.
Yeah.
So I think to try, even though the question of consent in Luke 1 feels really anachronistic, to be aware that still people in a modern era receiving this story,
mm-hmm.
we are where we are. We're not in first century Palestine. Right? Yeah. Like, are in 21st century wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are going to be, the scripture meets us where we are.
Sure.
Right. And so how do we negotiate that relationship? Can we pivot for a minute?
Sure, sure.
So when we talked about the traditions that have been built up around a good Christmas nativity story, one of those, of course, is baby Jesus in the stable. I'm just so excited.
Sweet baby Jesus.
In all the lowly cattle stall, right?
Yeah.
In all the carols. And it's a big part of our story, which again, like, is all Luke. None of that's in Matthew, right? Matthew is not on that train. Matthew's the one where they go to Egypt, right?
Yeah.
And it's totally. You're like, wow, I didn't think about Jesus. When you look at the timeline in Matthew, you don't know how long Jesus was raised in Egypt before they came back, right? It just says
it's been a while.
Had to wait for this king to die, but then we found out his son was still ruling and that freaked us out. So we went to Nazareth, right? And you're like, nobody ever asks me, like, how do you think Jesus was influenced by his early years in Egypt?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we ask that? That's what Matthew says. Anyway, it's fine.
We pick and choose.
We pick and choose.
We do. So.
Yeah, well, again, because we're focused on the Christmas story as we tell it, right, in the play. And what that means, I was talking about this with the students the past couple of weeks as we were reviewing Luke and Matthew separately, is while I think that for children it's helpful to simplify when you have two different stories to kind of pick your highlights from each and be like, here you go.
Yes.
As adults, we lose so many layers of richness and message and complexity for each of those stories because we've mashed them together. I mean, that's kind of the issue with the four gospels in general, right? It's like when you sort of, you're like, the life of Jesus, smash, 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 and you take these four distinct stories. But when you're able to say Luke has a story he wants to tell us about Jesus' origins, and Matthew has a story he wants to tell us, and they weren't consulting, right? Like they have different agendas.
And Luke is later.
For Matthew, the reference to not only the flight to Egypt, but the massacre of infants, right? I mean, he is alluding to the Moses story as well, right? And that's kind of Jesus' connection to Moses, and how for Matthew, there's going to be Jesus has, in some ways, is the new Moses, right? Which for Luke, Jesus is. That's not his point.
No.
He's not setting up a Jesus is the new Moses situation. What I do love, this is a total derailment of my earlier direction, but that's all right.
It's
we'll
fine.
Get back to it.
We'll come back.
We'll come back to it. What I do love in each of the stories is that the initial worshiping audience for Jesus is unexpected. Right? I mean, so in Luke, we have this announcement to these random shepherds who were in the region, right? I mean, it's like, and when I was talking to the students, I'm like, you have to understand, in the region, in the pictures, it's like the hill and the stable's right at the bottom of the hill. And so they're like, oh, let's go see. And they like walk down the hill.
Right? Like, they're neighbors.
They were just right there and they were picked because they were right there.
Yes.
And I'm like, in the region is kind of a big statement.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I have to assume it's a bigger deal that they left their flocks to go find this child in a nearby town. Also, the star is Matthew. So this idea that the shepherds were following the star is like, no, that, you know, oh, so I don't know how they found this baby, right? They found this sign.
They were talking to sheep, according to, forget the title of that song.
The First Noel?
No, it's not even, it's, Do You Hear What I Hear?
Oh, Do You Hear What I Hear?
The sheep tells the shepherd boy tells the king. The king tells the people. But it starts with the animals.
Oh, yeah, the carol.
So maybe the shepherds were conversing with the sheep.
Maybe they took their sheep with them. Lead the way, Bobo. Yes. So the shepherds in Luke, right, become that first audience where when you think about welcoming a king and savior, you're probably not like the angels were really excited and brought out full regalia, right? It was this whole choir of angels singing these poor shepherds who had the night watch, right? And we're like, okay, that was weird. cool. And then you
this
have
this night just got interesting.
Just got really, yeah. Everyone's getting surprise visits from the angels, right? And then in Matthew, we have the Magi, right? Who are essentially Zoroastrian priests from what was formerly Persia, right? And this kind of like, they're not even Jewish. And they're, you know, and it's like, so they're trucking over from Persia following a star because they're astrologers. And so that's a totally bizarre audience, right? To come worship the king and to say that in Matthew's story, that's also very intentional that the actual king, the Herod figure, and the chief priests and the scribes are threatened by the news of this birth and reject the news of this birth. Whereas these like foreign astrologers come bearing extremely expensive presents and are willing to kneel in front of a mother and her new baby. With reverence. And so both of those are very subversive.
They're foreshadowing though, right?
Yes, they are.
But when you look at the purpose of each book, which you were referring to, it's very methodical how it was laid out. It's like, well, this is a story that we want. And the theme is recurring.
Right. And that's what, I mean, to me, part of what's so beautiful about the Bible is this question of how people who told stories, right, from whom we have collected these stories in mm-hmm. our biblical canon, the point was to communicate truth through your story,
mm-hmm.
not historical detail. And so it's like, how do I tell the truthiest truth in my gospel so that people will understand Jesus?
The truthiest truth.
And so when we treat it like a historical documentary, or we insist that, like, no, these stories need to match mm-hmm. because they're about the historical thing that happened, it's like, no, that's also anachronistic. That's a very modern mindset.
Yeah.
Like, these stories do not need to match. And the fact that they don't doesn't make them any less true. It just means that they're not documentary footage of what happened at his, you know, like a
exactly.
historical event.
Yeah. You're going to mention a point about Palestine.
I was.
And so you had found this article that I found riveting.
It was so interesting.
And it's another debunking myth.
It is. The article is called Jesus Was Not Born in a Stable.
Mm.
I'm going to pull it up so that I can properly reference the author for okay. anyone who wants to look it up.
We'll send you a link if you ask us nicely.
That's true. We would. Jesus Was Not Born in a Stable by Ian Paul. And so he's writing about the Luke story and this popular mythology that we have about Jesus being born in a stable mm-hmm. that, again, is in all of our Christmas carols and all these things. This Ian Paul is writing about the word that we translate as in
mm-hmm.
and the fact that Jesus was born in a manger.
Mm-hmm.
And is basically saying, so first of all, when we read this popular translation that there was no room in the inn, this word, it's understandable why it would be translated that way. But in the historical context of the use of this word, it also typically refers to the extra room in a person's home
mm-hmm.
where you would offer hospitality to a guest if there were need for that. And he says, you have to understand that, like, anybody who knows Palestinian culture would be able to tell you it is
everybody knows this.
Everybody except for, like, Western Europeans who have been, like, a massive part of dispensing these stories. Where in Western culture, we're like, if there were animals there, this was a barn,
mm-hmm.
right? He's like, that makes sense why we would say that. Mm-hmm. But that's not how it worked in first century.
And not even attached to the house, but like an right. adjacent
a
structure.
A stable off on a hill somewhere because the inn was full. And he's like, first of all, when you talk about hospitality culture,
mm-hmm.
there is no way Joseph went to his, like, ancestral town,
yeah.
right, where he could speak his lineage and people would be like, sorry, I don't have room for you, right? Like, that's not going to happen.
They can't sit here.
That's right. You'd be, like, sleeping stacked on each other before somebody said there wasn't yeah. room, right? So there's no way he would not have been welcomed into a home. The mm-hmm. fact that there was no room in the inn would have made much more sense that what that means is either their guest quarters were already occupied.
Yeah.
Or the no room literally means that space is too small in which to properly give birth.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, this is, imagine a space that's literally big enough for a person to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
If you have ever been a person in labor, you know that's not enough room in which to do your thing. Right? Like, that's not going to work. As Mary went into labor, she might have been moved back into the main living space. And so you have to imagine these homes in first century Palestine, the animals are kept literally, like, if you think about it, kind of in the house, right? There's like
the foyer area, right?
Exactly. Like, all of this is the same space. The mm-hmm. animals are there. The manger is probably in the living room, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's just right there. And it's the best place to put a baby, right? That's what you're probably going to do. If Mary's like, I'm going to sleep, put the baby in that box. And, like, we just trust that
throw
the
some hay on it. It'll be
right.
fine.
We'll just trust the cows not to eat it. And to say, like, what does it change about this story for us
mm-hmm.
if Mary, Joseph, and Jesus are in the hub of a busy family?
Yeah.
In the midst of warm hospitality, Mary was assisted in her birth, right? This sort of story about the loneliness and
yeah.
the poverty.
The poverty always sticks out for me, but
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and to say, like, the reason that it's been such a dear story the way it is because it creates that very sharp contrast to the Caesars and the, you know, that, like,
yeah.
the situation is so humble and so sad, which
So for desolate me, and despondent.
Right? Exactly. That's how I've heard, right? Is like God wanted to create this amazing contrast. Mm-hmm. And they're like, the thing is, when you create that contrast, it also removes Jesus from a sense of normalcy, right? Like being just a normal baby. Because mm-hmm. it's equally extraordinary to be born out in the wilds of a barn by mm-hmm. yourself with your mom, right? Like it's much more just sort of typical and ordinary.
Yeah.
To be born in the midst of family and like to have that be a crowded, messy, you know, situation. Yeah. In a way humanizes the story.
Yes.
In a way that's invitational to us on a different level.
What would it mean to not be able to find a place? Mm-hmm. Like just journeying and being tired and being turned away. Like this whole story that unfolds.
But that's the other thing that's so funny about the nativity play, right? Like the innkeeper, mm-hmm. not a person in the story, right? Again, we just kind of create these characters. Yeah, right?
It's like there's no room for you. It's like, interesting. Yeah. But it makes it accessible just to give birth and to be surrounded by family, especially during COVID.
Yeah, all right.
Oh my gosh, dragging that in again. But just like this whole environment where I think people relate more to the isolation now mm-hmm. than before. And then to have this other nugget revealed where it's like, no, they were surrounded by family. It's like, oh my gosh, even Jesus had family around.
Well, and so this is a little bit of a side point, but like, so we have a 4-year-old at home mm-hmm. and I've been trying to think
who's
about.
We?
Oh, you're right. Carolyn and I don't have a 4-year-old at home. My spouse and I do.
There we go.
Yes. And we've been trying to, well, I have mostly been trying to find a nativity set that I feel really good about her growing up with.
Yeah. Right?
And the thing about nativity sets is they're all often, not anymore, but so many of them are the white European looking people.
They're starting to change that. Yeah.
They're starting, you know, so exciting. 2020, y'all. And secondly, it's always the same people, right? So it's like Mary, Joseph, the baby, the shepherd, the angel, the magi, mm-hmm. and animals.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's no midwife.
No.
Right? Like, first of all, I mean, getting into the pieties around like, the magi shouldn't have been there. Brr, 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 right?
Get out.
So I've started to crochet my own nativity
scene
where I'm like, and here's a midwife for Mary. And here, you know, and I fortunately have not gotten to a structure yet. So now I'm like, I could crochet a whole bunch of family mm-hmm. that would just be with them. And it would be this crowded little, I'll put them in a little cardboard box where they're all crowded together. And Mary's like, give me room. I'm having a baby.
You out. You can stay.
Yeah, boys, go for a hike. Give me some space.
Go find those shepherds.
There we go. Yeah. Because that's like, Mary's always the only woman on the scene.
Yeah.
There's never a second woman there. And so not only is it an erasure of who would have been Mary's midwife support mm-hmm. while she's giving birth, which I would love to have in the scene that my child grows up with.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to create some representation or acknowledgement of the mothers weeping for the loss of their babies.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the fact that understandably is not something people want in their cozy little nativity scene is like a sobbing woman with a murdered child. But it's a part of the story that then gets lost.
No, and it makes it fuller. It mm-hmm. makes it a story that you can relate to on some level. Yeah. I think that's great. Any final thoughts?
No. That was my final thought.
I think that's a great final thought to end on. So, well, that's the end of our show. I'm Terilyn Lawson.
And I'm Claire Joseph Meyer.
And that's what she said. You'll next hear a song by Two Button Brass. We've had them before, and they'll be doing a little Christmas ditty called Jingle Bells. Till next time.